It's 6:15 now, and time for some business news where our guest editor also features. Simon Jack is here with it. Simon?
Yes, indeed. And her focus is the City of London and its role in our lives. She's asked John Rees, writer, broadcaster, and one of the founders of the People's Assembly Against Austerity, co-author of A People's History of London, to give us his take.
When David Cameron had something to say about austerity last November, namely that it was going to be, in his words, permanent, he chose to say it amidst the gilt and gold of the Lord Mayor's banquet at the Guildhall in the heart of the City of London. The venue could not have been more appropriate, for there are two cities in London, the City of London, the financial square mile, and the larger metropolis of which it's a part. Cameron chose to speak in the city of banks and corporations, not the city of working London. As you leave London and enter the city, passing the special bollards bearing the crest of the City of London, you enter a place apart. This city has its own police force, its own laws, and a special seat in the House of Commons occupied by the Remembrancer, whose job, and a £5 million a year office, is charged with the task of ensuring that the interests of the city are not damaged by the careless acts of elected representatives. Even the electoral system in the city is different, where businesses have votes according to the number of people they employ. But where did all this begin? I went down to the Museum of London, which stands exactly on the line of the old wall around the city, to talk to Dr. Ariel Hassian of Goldsmiths College, University of London.
The key transition of money is really something that happens in the 17th century, particularly with the diversification of goldsmith activities. From the 1660s, 1670, they're beginning to issue notes saying, "I promise to pay the bearer." They're beginning to issue cheques for the first time from about 1670. The focus that England has becomes much more international. It looks much more out into the continent. And William of Orange needs British finance to fund his wars against Louis XIV. Money is always the sinews of war, and what he needs is extensive amounts of income to be able to fight those wars. So he needs to centralise the debt into a public national bank, and we get this with the formation of what becomes the Bank of England in 1694. The connection with war is absolutely fundamental. You're paying for the war on the promise of getting the money, and you need a central organisation. The financing of war is an extremely political agenda.
As soon as the city was established as a financial centre in its modern form, it went bust in one of the most spectacular crashes of all time. The South Sea Company was a slave trading company, but the real centre of the company's business was banking. The company took on the national debt of Great Britain after the War of the Spanish Succession in 1713. This early private finance initiative made the company all the rage among the elite. Politicians, ministers, and the king's mistress all bought shares and found themselves bound to the fate of the company. The price of South Sea Company shares rocketed from £100 to £1,000 each in a year. But as with every bubble, it had to burst. The price crashed back to £100 a share before the end of 1720. Banks and goldsmiths failed. Broken investors were outraged, Parliament was recalled, an investigation was announced, and when it reported in 1721, it revealed fraud at the highest levels among company directors and the cabinet. The Chancellor of the Exchequer, the Postmaster General, the Southern Secretary, Lord Stanhope and Sunderland were all implicated. Ministers were impeached and the Lord Chancellor imprisoned. If there's been any change in subsequent crashes, it's that the penalties for the rich have tended to be less severe. But the links between the city and Parliament are as strong as ever. Some 68 MPs and Lords have controlling interests or directorships in corporations linked to tax havens. At a time when privatisation of the NHS is being debated, over 75 MPs have business interests directly linked to private pharmaceutical firms. I talked to Oxford Professor Danny Dorling about the effect of having a powerful financial sector so hermetically sealed from the society of which it is a part.
You can see the spreading out to Canary Wharf and so on, and the buildings rising up there, and the area is very nearby where the people who work in Canary Wharf will not live. But there's also another hidden city, which is towards Mayfair, where all you get to see are brass plaques on the wall, because they don't need to advertise themselves. These are the hedge funds that only operate for the extremely wealthy. The kind of decamping of the poor from London is now becoming widespread. It was originally the city area and the areas immediately around the City of London that this first happened to. Now we're seeing the pushing out and the eviction of a much wider group of people, partly purely for market forces. You know, the average house price in London is heading over $500,000, and that's changing who can be there. The other thing it's very important to say about London, and what's so different to London to the rest of Europe, is that London has a couple of thousand bankers who are earning over $1 million a year, whereas the next highest is less than 200 in the whole of Germany. I mean, this really is a very, very odd situation.
London is one of the most unequal cities in the world. The average wealth of the top 10% of Londoners is over £1 million compared to a meagre £3,500 for the poorest 10%, a wealth multiple of over 270. But not all the rich live in the City of London. Perhaps they commute from Elbridge in Surrey, population 131,000, where property is now worth as much as the entire residential assets of the City of Glasgow, population 600,000. Or perhaps they don't actually live in the UK at all. So-called super prime real estate, the top 5% of the most valuable properties, is over 50% owned by private funds and individuals from abroad, leading to the lights out syndrome of the richest areas of the city where houses are owner unoccupied. All this while a desperate housing shortage is felt at the bottom of the wealth pyramid. This wealth disparity is literally a matter of life and death. Life expectancy drops by 1 year for every stop travelled east on the Underground from Westminster on the Jubilee line. Adults in Hackney are twice as likely to die before their 65th year as those living in Kensington and Chelsea. The effect of the City of London is felt on the whole course of national economic development. Bank assets as a percentage of the entire wealth of the country have risen by nearly 200% since the Big Bang of the 1980s. Banks have become so important that in the 2008 crash, the government spent much more money to bail them out than in any comparable economy. Support for the banking sector in France was just 20% of national wealth. In Germany, 25%. Even in the United States, where the crisis began, it was only 35%. But in the UK, the government pumped money into the banks that was worth nearly 90% of our national wealth. I went down to the Royal Exchange, one of the oldest trading sites in the city, to talk to James Meadway, senior economist of the New Economics Foundation, about the economic impact of the city.
Particularly after 1986 or so, it's positioning itself as a hub for money dealing right the way across the rest of the world. This is only incidentally related to what you or I or anybody else in the country does on a kind of day-to-day basis. Of course, we have large banks and it's a monetary economy, so we make use of them. But if you're talking about the city, this is focused on the rest of the world. And the offer, really, that it makes is, if you want to come and do some money dealing of some sort, if you want to create derivatives, if you want to trade options, if you want to do all these things, come to the city, because it's cheap, we have people able to do it, you'll make a load of money out of it, it's a very permissive regulatory environment, we have a government that thinks what you're doing is great. It's a really good place for you to do this sort of thing.
In fact, although city boosters claim that the city creates jobs, there are just 332,000 jobs in banking out of a workforce of 4 million in London. James Meadway again.
It's the loss of manufacturing jobs which are offered, usually, more secure, better paid than certainly what replaces them, which for most people over a period of time becomes worse paid, insecure, service sector jobs where you don't have the kind of protections that had developed in manufacturing industry. So you get a hollowing out of the labour market. You find lots and lots of people in these kind of service sector jobs that are actually not particularly pleasant. The appearance by now of 0 hours contracts, of falling wages, all the rest of it. And then a tiny section of society, particularly associated with financial services, does very, very well out of all of this. If you take, you know, the top 1%, you're talking at a good third are involved directly in financial services. There's a very, very large chunk of very rich people are directly engaged in financial services and have done very well out of the appearance of the city as such a major financial hub.
This isn't the city that David Cameron likes to talk about. In his view, the city is an engine for the economy, a wealth generator. Its great oligarchs are worth the riches that they are paid. But that simply isn't the case. The city is a crash-prone debt generator. It is an engine of inequality. It disfigures the economy and blights the city. It is, as William Cobbett, the great 19th century radical, described it, the great wen, a boil on the face of the nation.
I wander through each chartered street near where the chartered Thames does flow, and mark in every face I meet marks of weakness, marks of woe. In every cry of every man, in every infant's cry of fear, in every voice, in every ban, the mind-forged manacles I hear. How the chimney sweeper's cry every blackening church appalls, and the hapless soldier's sigh runs in blood down palace walls. But most through midnight streets I hear how the youthful harlot's curse blasts the newborn infant's tear and blights with plagues the marriage hearse.
Rafe Fiennes ending that report by the writer John Rees. Well, my markets guest today is Brenda Kelly, Chief Market Strategist at IG. Good morning to you.
Good morning.
A lot in that report, inequality between rich and poor, demise of manufacturing, but the stuff that was directly about the city, defend yourself, defend your industry.
Well, it has to be looked at from the benefits point of view, and the tax paid by the UK Financial Services in the last year were £65 billion. That's equivalent to 11.7% of the total tax received to the Exchequer. If you also look at corporation tax, it was £6.5 billion last year, which is up from £5.4 billion the year before, and that's 16.4% of the total paid by British businesses. So if you look at that and you look at the combined balance of payments that comes from the financial sector, this is helping to offset the trade deficit that's coming from the manufacturing.
So it may be an unpleasant goose, but it lays golden eggs would be your sort of defence. What about that point about the fact that when it came to bailing out the banks, London is even worse than anywhere else because more money was used to bail out the banks than in comparable other countries?
It's true, but as I've said, that it has been wholly justifiable by those figures and the fact that it has such an impact on GDP here. I do agree to some extent that there has been, there's a reinforcement here that there have been a lack of government efforts to rebalance the economy away to the likes of manufacturing and different regions. But nevertheless, the city has had an historical place within the UK and has, generally speaking, been the powerhouse of the economy.
Okay, just let's move on from that. We'll talk a little bit more. PJ Harvey will have lots of contributions throughout the programme. Looking elsewhere, 2014, first trading day of the year, markets will open. What will be the factors determining what happens this year?
I think what we're needing to see, actually, is an increase in manufacturing, construction and industry, ironically. If they look at the FTSE 100, by comparison to the European and US counterpart, it has underperformed substantially, up 14% in the year. You look at the Dow Jones, up around 28, 30%, and even Germany, at all-time highs. We still haven't seen the FTSE around the 7,000 mark ever. So if we see an impact from the likes of China in terms of industry and demand for exports, that should have an impact on the FTSE and give it a better performance this year.
Okay, Brenda Kelly, Chief Market Strategist at IG. Many thanks.